Conversations with Apollo, episode number 6, The Big Chair.
In the whole history of man, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
Jerry Griffin is my guest on Conversations with Apollo. He was the flight director for, I believe, your first flight director mission as head flight director was Apollo 12. Is that correct?
That was my first as a lead flight director. Actually, my first flight director was Apollo 7, and Glenn Lunny was the lead flight director on that flight, but I was I had one of the shifts on Apollo 7. Then after that, I actually worked on every Apollo flight after all the manned flights, 7 through 17. And but 12 was the first time that I was the so-called lead flight director, which was the flight director that had the responsibility for pulling the whole mission together from the Mission Control Center standpoint and then working with the other flight directors to run their shifts. I was also lead flight director on Apollos 15 and 17. And so I did three of those, 12, 15, 17, but I was a flight director on just another shift for all the other lunar missions.
So how does one go about actually becoming the Apollo flight director? Take us through the journey that took you to NASA and had you ended up being in the big seat.
Well, and I'll try to keep this tight enough so it doesn't become ancient history, but when I graduated from college, I was an aeronautical engineer, but I also was ROTC. I was graduated from Texas A&M, so all of us went into the service. I went into the service as a second lieutenant and was flying in the backseat of fighter interceptors and did that for 4 years. And in 1960, of course, that was in 1960 by the time I had been in for 4 years. If you'll remember then, NASA was formed in 58. After Sputnik, and then here comes Gagarin, and here comes Al Shepard in Mercury on our side. And I knew I wanted to get into the space business. I could feel it then that, hey, this is where it's going to be. So I got out of the Air Force. I only had a three-year commitment. Actually, I stayed four. But I went to work at the Satellite Test Center in Centerville, California, and that was an Air Force unmanned satellite center, and it was a good grounding for a good beginning. But as soon as Shepard and Glenn flew, I knew I had to get to NASA and get into the manned side. So I just kept plugging at it. I talked with Gene Kranz, who of Apollo 13 fame, that you may the guy with the vest. Finally went to work in 1964 as a flight controller. And I did that for all of Gemini. I was a navigation and guidance system
So you were a guide
controller. No, actually, I was a GNC, a guidance,
GNC,
navigation, and control. And GNC, you had those systems that were guidance and navigation. You also had the propellant systems for the control system. So anyway, I did that till the end of Gemini. And I was getting ready to do the same thing for Apollo. In fact, I was going to be a GNC on Apollo, and I was in the control center the night of the fire. And
can you talk about
one?
Can you talk about that? How much? Would you want to talk about? I guess is
well, it's not too difficult to talk about now. You know, the space business has got a certain amount of risk in it. There was an awful lot of learning and that was going on. Our learning curves were all very steep. And when we got to the Apollo 1 time, when we were getting ready, I think we were all just kind of lulled into a sense of false security, mainly by the fact that we had flown all of Mercury and all of Gemini with 100% oxygen environment inside the command module or the capsule. And we did that for a lot of reasons. High-altitude airplanes had been doing it for a long time, breathing 100% oxygen, that and it was a way to avoid the bends and on descent and that, or ascent and that sort of thing. And so we had that 100% oxygen. We still, you know, to this day don't know really what started the fire, but in that kind of environment, anything that will burn will burn. It was high pressure, 100% oxygen. And whatever triggered that fire, and it was over in it pretty quick. I heard it. We were in the control center in Houston. It was a countdown demonstration test. So it was just like a real launch, except for the fact that there was no propellant in the Saturn. And so when it happened, after we got past the initial phases of all that, and I remember that night very well, I was asked to go downstairs in the Mission Control Center and listen to voice tapes to see if we could pick up anything that the crewman had said that would help us know what happened.
Boy, that must have been a brutal experience.
It was. Although, you know, after a while you kind of, I don't know, I think maybe it was the emotion, as much as the emotion and adrenaline and anger and everything else at having it happen, I approached it pretty, I can remember, pretty forensic-like. It was only later that I realized that, you know, that hell, this is, it was not a good thing, and it was really a terrible way to go. But we didn't get a lot out of that voice tape. We slowed it, you know, they enhanced it and all that. Well, to make a long story that's already long, I'll try to shorten it a little bit. I was, after the fire, I was selected to be on Frank Borman's team. Frank led a team that went out to Downey, California, where they built the command module, and we essentially kind of redesigned the whole thing to take anything flammable out of it, so that it, or if we put anything flammable inside the command module, and it's still the same way today with shuttle, it would be under very careful control, and you'd know exactly how much was there and so forth. We also changed from 100% oxygen to 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen mix, which is about what we breathe here on Earth, which is much less fire-sustaining than 100% oxygen. So we made those two big changes, and while I was shuttling back and forth between Houston and Downey on Borman's team, they decided they needed some more flight directors. Well, now this is, you ask, how do you be a flight director? You might have to ask Chris Kraft that, because I was selected in between the time of the fire and in between the time we finally flew Apollo 7, I was selected to be one of three new flight directors. And it was a great honor, and it was also, I knew, a great responsibility. By that time, Chris Kraft had decided that he could no longer, he was director of flight operations, and he just could not be a flight director in the control center. And John Hodge, another flight director in the early days, had moved on to a headquarters. So we just needed more bodies to be a flight director. And so that's how I got there. I happened to be staying in the right place in the right time, and I guess I had impressed Chris and the other leadership, Kranz, probably enough that I was lucky enough to be selected. And I have to say, it was one of the greatest jobs. Well, it's probably the greatest job I ever had in my life. I was 33 years old. I later became director of the Johnson Space Center 17 years later, I guess. I think it was about that, because I was close to 50. And I had more responsibility in a way as a flight director than I did as the director of the center. And the reason is, here's this 33-year-old kid, could move carrier forces from one ocean to another to get them in the right place for recovery. I could direct the operations of control centers and tracking centers as far away as Australia. And you know, it was really a neat job. It reminded me, in a way, of the time I had spent as in a fighter squadron. Because it was a group of people that didn't know they couldn't do anything. They would try anything that was asked of them. There was a bit of a scarf over the neck, but let's do it safely. But let's do it with, make sure we try not to leave anything overturned, but recognize all the time this is a risky business, guys, and you can get hurt in it. And so it was a little bit like being in a fire squadron, which I thought was kind of neat. So that's how I got there, and it was a great experience, and one I'll never forget.
So is it true that the authority that a flight director commands is near absolute?
It is, and let me tell you why that is. In the early days of Mercury, there was an occasion, and there were a couple of them early. I wasn't there yet, but where some of the people from the headquarters environment had kind of interceded during a flight, and they made a couple of wrong calls, nothing that hurt anybody, but in looking back at it, the guys there at the time, primarily Kraft, realized that this was, it could be done better. From that point on, he made the decision. He said, look, the flight director, in terms of, obviously he's got to listen to inputs from people like program offices and the engineering people and the crew support folks and all of that. He's got to listen to it, but he's going to have the final decision, and nobody's going to question it. We're not going to second-guess him and have a number of people saying, oh, no, don't do that. And that's the way we operated. That came into play very much on Apollo 12. Some people probably don't remember it, but
personal favorite mission, actually.
Yeah, and it was my baptism of fire as an ascent flight controller, a launch flight controller or flight director, and my first flight as lead flight director. And so, a little less than a minute after liftoff, we got hit by lightning. Yeah, as a matter of fact, and. Of course, it knocked everything offline in the command module, and thank goodness the Saturn kept operating fine. And that I thought it was going to have to call an abort, but it was following right up the planned trajectory, and that was because the Saturn had its own guidance system, and thank goodness it survived the lightning strike. So anyway, it was going uphill, and I said, well, if we're going to abort, let's get high as we can before we have to. Let's don't do it low. But it became fairly obvious after a while that we were going to make it into orbit and be able to maybe get ourselves down in a controlled kind of way. And the reason I bring that point up is because Chris, I never forget this, came down to me. He was the director of flight operations, actually sat at a console right behind the flight director. And he came down and he just said, whatever the call is, it's yours. And I kind of said to myself, gulp, okay. Well, we got into orbit, and he said, you know, we don't have to go to the moon today. We just don't have to do it, but it's your call. And so we took all the inputs from all the people, and we did a couple of tests on the spacecraft after we got everything, all the power back on and all that, and decided, look, we've got to do an entry anyway because we're in orbit. And so why don't we just do an entry from the moon? Let's go on to the moon, and if since we've got the risk of an entry anyway, let's do the entry coming from the moon. So we went on to the moon. The bottom line was the rest of the mission worked just fine. And but Chris actually, you know, he really did exactly what he had been preaching, that it was the flight director's call. And in his book, he took nice note of that and said some nice things about me. But it was really Chris himself that had empowered that kind of management approach to flight operation. They're just, you know, it just comes down to the point at the end of the day. It just comes down to the point that somebody's got to make a decision. You can't do it all by committee. You got to have somebody in charge. And Kraft's approach to that is it should be the flight director, and he laid it on us, and we all enjoyed taking that responsibility.
Not to mention that if anybody could overrule you, then then it becomes a case of you'd probably end up getting overruled more often than, and the mission would pretty much fall apart at that point.
That's right.
And somebody pretty much has to be the dictator.
Exactly right.
So take us through the Apollo 12 mission from your seat.
Well, you know, 12 was an interesting mission. We had just flown 11, of course, the mission before it, and had made a landing on Tranquility, at Tranquility Base in the Sea of Tranquility, and that was a very flat area. It was chosen for that reason, that it was a fairly easy place to land, we thought, even though Neil had to dodge some boulders at the end. Apollo 12 was a lot different, and on 11, we were really aimed at landing anywhere that was a good place in the Sea of Tranquility that was flat enough to land on, and weren't not too peculiar or not too fussy about where we landed.
But 12, you had, target.
Yeah, 12, we had a target because a Surveyor spacecraft, an unmanned one that had been sent up years earlier, was sitting there, and we wanted to get some parts off of it and see how the long-term effects of space, and particularly in the moon environment, might affect some of that hardware. So we had a precise pinpoint landing to make, and we did. And it was more rugged. There were craters and some bigger humps and all that we had to contend with. But Conrad and crew put it right down where as soon as they landed, he looked out the window, he could see the Surveyor. And sitting over there, which later in a later EVA they went over and picked parts off of it and brought it back for analysis and that sort of thing. So it was an entirely different kind of landing, and it proved to us that we could put the darn thing where we wanted it, which was going to be very important for some later flights where we were going into some very rugged areas. And we had to know that we could do that, because if we didn't, we were probably going to have to abort and not even land. So 12 proved that. The other thing about 12 that happened that I thought was very good is that after our shaky start with the lightning strike and all of the tests that we did and so forth, that was the last problem we had. It was one of the cleanest flights, and those of us that in Mission Control kept talking about it, you know, well, we're sure we're going to run into another problem here sooner or later. But we didn't. It was just a very, very clean flight, and everything worked the way it was supposed to work.
Well, with the exception of the camera, but we all know why that happened.
Well, yeah, the camera, I try to take it easy on Alpine every once in a while. I'll make that story quick. Al and I grew up in the same hometown. We didn't, Fort Worth, Texas, and we didn't know it. We didn't know each other at the time. And he went to the University of Texas, and I went to Texas A&M University. Big rivals, and we still didn't know each other, but then, aha, we met at NASA. And so we always had this fun thing. He went to a rival high school, incidentally, in Fort Worth, too. So we had this kind of friendly rivalry going on. We were always talking football and stuff like that with each other. Well, when he got on the moon, he didn't put a lens cap on the TV camera at the right time, and it looked at the sun and it burned it up, and so we lost that camera, and I've never let him forget about it. Every time I see him, I have to ask him about the TV camera on the moon. But it was a fairly minor loss, and the cameras weren't as good in those days as they became later.
It was still black and white. I mean,
it was pretty primitive. And so, like I say, it wasn't as big a loss as it would have been had it happened on a later flight. We fixed that so that the thing had an automatic shutdown in it, that if it got too much light, it would shut it down. But the rest of that flight was really good, and we learned a lot from it. For one thing, when things go smoothly, you've got enough time to kind of sit back and analyze what the systems are doing and how they're doing it. And 12 gave us an early, on a real lunar landing mission, gave us an early clean mission where we could really kind of contemplate things and not have to be fighting problems all the way. So it was a good flight. And except for the lightning piece in the front end, It was probably about as good a flight as a brand new lead flight director could have.
So you go from Apollo 12, and you're in Apollo 13. Everybody knows the story. We've all seen the movie, but there was a lot of things about that flight as I was reading Jim Lovell's book that I didn't know about before. For like the whole worry about the limb reentering the Earth's atmosphere with the nuclear pellet on board or whatever that they used to power.
Yeah, it was a lunar experiment.
And you guys had to alter the trajectory so that the limb would end up going into a really deep spot when it burned up. And there's just a lot about that particular mission, which frankly was a miracle.
It was an interesting flight. And unlike 12, of course, which had been so clean, 13 gave us the ultimate challenge. So they were entirely different kind of missions. My team was going to do the descent to the moon on that flight, of course, which we never got to. So my team became one of the recovery teams, if you will. And it was just, it was just kind of a constant battling, trying to figure out how much we had left of consumables and what we were going to do. And that, so it was just a constant 3.5-4 days of trying to figure out how we were going to proceed. The interesting thing about 13, though, is that we were trained to handle those kind of things. And there's an interesting story in the making of the movie when Ron Howard decided that he was going to look at making the movie. He had his people contact several of us that had been part of the mission to meet with him and ask if we would come to Houston and meet with him and talk about it. He was still undecided whether he was going to try to make a movie on it. And so we did. There were about six or seven of us, I think, that met him in Houston. We stood around the old flight director console, and we were, in fact, Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon and others were there. We didn't know we were going to be there, but and some Universal Studio people and the writer, I think the film writer, screenwriter. But to make a long story short, we talked about it, and Ron, I could tell Ron was interested in trying to figure out, is there enough emotion in this? Is there enough drama and emotion in the thing to make a movie and make it interesting? And of course, at the bottom line, he decided there was, and it turned out great. But he kept asking us questions like, well, were you scared, And all of us kind of looked at each other and said, no, we weren't scared, because this is what we were trained to do. And we had, we had simulations on every flight that would sometimes even make Apollo 13 look pale. The sim guys that set those things up, we used to accuse them of trying to drive us to our knees, because they would throw failure on top of failure on top of failure, and we'd be staggering. And it was very lifelike. It was very high fidelity simulations, and you really forgot after a while that this was just practice. But we trained and trained, and we talked about mission rules and what we were going to do, and procedures and all that. So when 13 happened, we just kind of kept on like we had started. We had always been trained that as long as there were options remaining, don't give up, just keep plugging away. And that's what happened on 13. We never ran out of options. We were getting close. And in fact, the shortest consumable we had at the end of the flight was water. And it wasn't oxygen. We had plenty enough oxygen to get us back out of the limb, but we were short on water. We were getting short on water. I think we had something like 6 hours left when we got on the ground, and those guys had been drinking almost no water, and we didn't have the fuel cells to produce water, so we weren't producing any. So my bottom line is that we never ran out of options, and so we just kept going and plugging away and plugging away. Now, you said something about the lateness of late in the flight with some of the entry problem. You know, when the thing exploded, when the oxygen tank exploded in the back, one of our concerns in the back of our mind the whole time was that it may have damaged the heat shield, and there was no way of checking it. It was either damaged or it wasn't. And for some reasons, which I guess we still don't know why, we went into blackout on entry. We went into blackout, that period where the radio transmissions cannot get through the ion shield that the heat is, the gases are producing. We lost the signal right on time, and then and usually on every flight, when it was time to come out of blackout, we would hit it within 1 or 2 seconds, maybe 3 or 4 seconds maximum, the prediction would be missed. In this case, it just kept going and going. We didn't come out of blackout. And nobody said, you could have heard a pin drop in that control center. And nobody said a word, but I know I was thinking, you know, I wonder if that darn heat shield was damaged. And as soon as it was exposed to the high heat, gave way and burned the whole thing up. And but Joe Kerwin was the CAPCOM. I'll never forget that. And he kept calling him. Apollo 13, this is Houston. And kept saying it over and over and over. And in a minute, here comes Jack Swagger. Says, hello, Houston, it's Apollo 13. Everything's fine. And, man, everybody in that control center just, you know, you could hear the air come out of everybody. And it was, we still don't know why that was so late. And I think it was a minute and a half or 2 minutes late or something.
So even
like
looking,
that.
So even in the post-flight briefings, even looking at all the telemetry, they still don't know why it took so long?
No, and it was probably, it probably had to do with somebody with a radio out of, remember we didn't have a TDRS satellite then, we didn't have full-time control, you had to have a tracking station, and we had airplanes. Actually, I think we got communication through an airplane antenna first, and it was probably something to do with a switch out of configuration, something either in the cockpit, which they finally found and turned on and never told us, or somebody on the ground side had something out of configuration, and who knows? It could be any number of things, but it was a.
And that, does, that doesn't necessarily mean that the reentry itself took a minute and a half longer.
No,
just that the contact took a minute and a half longer.
The contact and. Yeah. And the funny thing about it too is that when it came out, I mean, as soon as we saw the chutes, everything was very normal. They landed very close to the aim point. So there was nothing wrong with the trajectory or anything like that. It was just some sort of comm foul up after having worried for 3.5 days and worried about the heat shield, it was really, kind of a low moment until we heard them. And then after that, of course, it worked out just fine.
Okay, so you get through Apollo 13, and like as you mentioned earlier, you pretty much were a flight director on just about every Apollo mission.
Right.
So tell me, of all the Apollo missions, which one for you is the watermark?
Well, this may surprise you, but to me, it was Apollo 8.
Best Christmas present ever.
It was the first time we left the Earth's sphere of influence, is what we call it. And I know we'll forget, and of course, and I had been in part of unmanned satellites in the Air Force at the Satellite Test Center in Centerville. I had been through the Mercury program as a spectator. But then I actually participated in all of Gemini and all of Apollo, all of the Earth orbit stuff, all the unmanned Saturn testing and all that kind of stuff. But Apollo 8 was the first, and we did it quickly, if you recall. Apollo 8 was not going to go to the moon, but we were literally in a race with the Russians at that point still. And it was decided we could do it and do it safely, and so we put the mission together fairly fast. And did it, pulled it off. But when we left, when we did the translunar injection burn, and I've heard it very quiet, I'd heard it very quiet in the control center, but it was like a tomb. in there, because as soon as they started that burn, we knew that we had committed to leaving the sphere of influence of the Earth. And, shoot, it gives me goosebumps to think about that now, how, and then when they went around the moon the first time and we lost the signal, in the 30-something minutes or so they were behind the moon, you know, this was when normally later in the program people get up and take a break and go to the restroom and grab a cup of coffee and that sort of thing. Nobody moved, because we wanted to see if they got into orbit, because they did that burn on the backside of the moon. We couldn't see it, and everybody sat there for about 30 something minutes, whatever that time is, and very little said. And of course, it worked just fine. And then they were there over Christmas and came home. So Apollo 8 to me was the first time that we proved with real life action that we could go to another body in our solar system and stay there or get there and put ourselves in position to land. So I think even more to me than Apollo 11, I think Apollo 8 was the high water mark, because, and by the way, I think that's when the Russians knew they had it. They, for sure, we were going to beat them. And we didn't spend, those of us in the program didn't spend a lot of time worrying about the Russians, because we had our own problems to deal with. But in retrospect, when I look back and look back at history and look back at the way the American space program went from there on, it's clear that they knew they had it. And I think they kind of dropped out at that point, and we had it to ourselves.
And the low mark of your
the low mark was probably was the low mark has to be the fire, and I don't mean that necessarily. The loss of life was a terrible thing to happen, and I knew all those guys well. But like I said, it's a risky business, and I remember my days in the fighter squadron. You know, I saw guys go down in airplanes that I was flying with, and flying on the same day with. And you build kind of a scar tissue against that piece of it that only affects you later. It doesn't bother you so much exactly when it happened. But what it proved, I think it was a low point to me, because it proved that we still had so much to learn about trying to do what we were trying to do something very difficult. We knew that, but we were pretty getting to ourselves pretty cocky that, you know, we were just going to make this all happen without running into any big obstacles. But we did. And we ran into something that we didn't expect. And so it caused not only a sadness with the loss, but it caused an anger and a, good God, how could we have been that dumb kind of reaction, you know, kind of hitting the side of your head. And so it was a low point, but rather than dwelling on it very long, and part of this is a result of the anger and the short kind of realizing that you fell short and so forth, we use that as an inspiration to get on with it and get it fixed and get going. And that was an interesting time in our history in the country, because we could do that then. Today, and we certainly had oversight on that thing. We had congressional oversight. We had White House involved. We had all kinds of people looking over our shoulders. Why'd you do that, or how could you have let that happen? But they didn't. There was not the naysayers that said, "Now we got to stop because it's too dangerous." It just didn't. It wasn't in people's makeup. Nowadays, those kind of things, if that same thing happened today in the political environment we have, I have a feeling we'd never fly again. And I don't know why I say that. It's been okay with the shuttle. There's been a lot of in the country hadn't stopped flying the shuttle. But going to the moon is a lot more difficult than going into low Earth orbit. And it was such a big task in front of us to get it done that I really kind of wonder if in today's environment, say, it's not worth it. You know, it's too much money, too much risk, et cetera.
And, yeah, but at the same time, do you really think that maybe not in the short run, but in the long run, we could actually permanently squelch that desire to explore? I mean,
no, I don't. I really don't think you could squelch it. And if we don't do it, if we the Americans don't do it, the Chinese will, or the Japanese will, or the Europeans will. It's going to happen anyway. And I think you're hitting on something there that is very important, that ability there, or that drive to explore and find out more about where we are in this big picture of space, and I'll use that term in its broadest sense, it's never going to go away. And unless we destroy the Earth and something prior to that gets us all, as long as there's humans walking on the Earth, I think they're going to want to go somewhere else and make sure they know where it is and what it is.
Do you subscribe to the notion that if it hadn't been for the Apollo fire, we might not have made the deadline?
Well, that's possible. I think the more likely thing was, probably the luckiest thing that happened to us about the fire is that it happened on the ground so that we could figure out what it was. And maybe not exactly what caused the spark that started it, but we could fix it. Imagine if that had happened on Apollo 8, about halfway to the moon, and you had a fire and you never heard from the crew again. You literally would never have heard from them again. That may have ended the program, because that would have really been a shocker.
Or if it had happened in lunar orbit, the next several months or weeks or however long it would take for the orbit to degrade, you'd look up at the moon and know that there were three dead bodies going around that.
Right, exactly. And so the fact that it happened where it did, it was probably fortunate, and it probably saved the program, because I really think it would have been. If we had no idea what it was, whether it was a light, some sort of meteorite that had taken the plate thing apart, or a fire just like we had, or whatever, that would have been a very difficult thing to press past, because there could even be people that would say, and you couldn't argue with them, there's an unknown situation that we've got here that we can't deal with, and your argument would be pretty hollow, because you just have to say, no, there isn't. Something happened, but we have no idea what it was.
In looking at the three losses that we've had with Challenger, Columbia, and Apollo 1, are they always in jeopardy of becoming either full of themselves or being overly confident about what is essentially a very dangerous and lethal business?
I don't think overconfidence is going to be it anymore. We may have a little, I wouldn't call it overconfidence. It was lack of knowledge. We were very confident, but our confidence was built on not nearly as much experience as the folks have had today. I don't think overconfidence will be an issue again. I like your word mindful. You've got to be mindful of the risk. I can tell you that people in the program are very mindful of the risk. And if we flew the shuttle 100 more times, we'd lose another one. I mean, I sit here and tell you. It's just like if we're going to lose another commercial airliner. When? Where? I don't know.
Yeah,
it's going to happen.
It's interesting that it doesn't stop us from flying airplanes.
No.
And we lose...
And we don't wipe out 3 or 7. We wipe out, couple of hundred, and if this new, what is it, the 380 and something, we might be able to wipe out 400 or 500 at once in one crash. So my point is that it is a risky business, and you've got to keep that in mind. I've always said that, and I think this is maybe this could be one of the more important things I say to you today. The job of NASA and of anybody that's on top of a very tough technical business that's got risk in it, it's the job of NASA is to manage the risk, and you want to manage it to as low a level as possible within your ability and resources and so forth. But you have to recognize you'll never drive the risk to zero. You might drive it down to 0.0001, but wherever it ends up in that small number, if you fly enough or if you do whatever, if you do enough coal mining or whatever, you're eventually going to have an accident. It's going to happen. The numbers get you. And so you've got to be mindful of that and do all you can to keep it from happening. But at the same time, and the people that finance it, in this case the shareholders of NASA or the American public, I believe it's important for the shareholders to recognize that there's going to be risk and there's going to be losses. Now, the second question, you drive the risk as low as you can, then you measure the risk versus the gain. Is the gain worth the risk? I think it is. I think everything we've done in space has been worth our losses. Doesn't make the losses any better. Doesn't make the losses acceptable. But when I look at it strictly as a risk versus gain question, I think the gain comes out on top.
Yeah, I'm reminded of what Gus Grissom said before he died, when he said that if they were to die on the mission, that they would want the program to continue, that the risk was worth it. And it bugs me that the naysayers, as you put it, who would call for the cancellation of NASA, would call for not going back into space, it bothers me that words from those who have died don't carry the resonance that they should.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, to some degree, that's understandable, and not that I agree with it. It's understandable. I know where our society in general has become very risk adverse. There's almost no risk worth dying for.
Do you think that's a result of being that we're a relatively young country and an unbelievably successful country?
Yeah, I think both of those are factors, and particularly the success. I look at people today who have never had it anything but good. I mean, really good. And so I think our success has naturally kind of inbred us with a feeling of well-being. I'm not going to take any risk. I don't have to. I'll let somebody else, and if there's somebody else that's got to go do the risky things, that's fine. Let them do that. I don't have to. I guess we've always had those kind of people in our society, clear back probably even the First and Second World Wars. But I think the numbers are much larger now. I think even the descendants of those folks that were very adventurous and that opened up the American West, for instance, I think some of their descendants, direct descendants, are now would no more do what their forebears did than anything. They just wouldn't do it. It'd be too risky, too dangerous. And I think it's because they didn't have to. It was kind of here when they appeared on the earth. Our standard of living and all that was right where they wanted it. So it just didn't happen.
So looking at, basing it upon your Apollo experience and looking to the new mission, the Orion project, what do you think of the new project? Do you think that what we just talked about the reticence to move forward and to move out and to take those risks and manage those risks, do you think that that's going to be a burden on the program? What are your impressions of the new program?
I do think it's going to be a burden, but let me, I think the concept is fine, I think, and in fact it's good, it's great, and how they're going about with the Orion and the other pieces of it, I think all of that is fine. The, The reality is, and this is the question I can't answer, is are we going to have, as a country, the resolve to provide the resources to get the job done? You know, when you're dealing with annual appropriations in the Congress, no multi-year appropriations or anything like that, you have a program, you know, that takes somewhere between six to 10 years to develop. And all you got to do is, just like we did on the shuttle, is you had a Congress that got skittish and they were cutting the funding, and we kept the program going. We had enough to just kind of keep the program going, but it caused us to spend more money in the long run because you have this standing army that you're trying to get ready to fly, marching in place, and there's no flight. So by the time we got to the first shuttle flight, the program was, quote, in an overrun situation, unquote. And, well, duh, yeah. What we were doing is using schedule to make up for enough resources to get the job done on schedule. So we just slipped the schedule. Well, when you do that, you're gonna run the cost up. And to me, the biggest worry I have about the whole Constellation endeavor is the funding of staying at an adequate enough level so that you don't get into the self-fulfilling prophecy that, oh, you're overrunning. Yeah, and the reason that you're overrunning is because you haven't met your schedule. So, well, but we don't have enough money to meet the schedule. So it's a catch-22. And I don't think there's any doubt that the people in the program today are very good. They're very smart. Going back to the moon and on to Mars is the way to do it. And we've got the capability, and it can be done. And I think it can be done at about the cost they're projecting. But the question is, are we going to have too many other things on our plate as a country that we've got to divert money to then it may affect us eventually. But
yeah, but
I'm optimistic about it. I think the only way to do this thing is not to play too many what ifs. I'd press forward. I think Mike Griffin, incidentally, no relation, but a good friend. I think Mike is doing the right thing. He's got the team aimed in the right direction, and they're doing all the right things. And shoot, let's just get behind it and keep it going.
The thing that concerns me is that we're going to be essentially flightless from the time we retire the shuttle to the time we actually launch the first mission. We're going to be flightless for like 7 years.
Yeah, it could be a long time, and we've gone through one of those already between the Apollo, the Skylab, and the shuttle. We flew the Skylab, you know, started in the mid-70s, finished it somewhere, I can't remember exactly where, and then we didn't fly till 81. So it was a long time without any human spaceflight. We were flying unmanned satellites, the country was, during that period, but
you were still at NASA during that time, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
What is that like to go through 7 years of not doing what you are designed to do?
Not fun and frustrating. We had plenty to do because shuttle was going to be a new kind of concept, turn it around, use the same hardware, long missions, et cetera, et cetera. So we had a lot to do in planning, but we ended up planning the hell out of it because we weren't flying anything. And again, we had some of that effect of the standing army being in place without a fight. So we were costing the agency, the flight operations people were costing the agency some money, and we weren't flying. So it was inefficient, but you could fire everybody and start all over. Although we did lose people. We lost people that got...
I was going to say, I assume there was a great brain drain during that time.
There was, and some of the contractors particularly lost some good people. NASA lost some good people. But there was the right core was still around to get it done. And we're going to have to see if there's, you know, I don't know all the intricacies of what they'll try to make sure they hold on to the A-team, let me call it that, maybe the A team and the B team, I might have to start losing some of the C's and D's and then fill those back in when we get flying. But there's a lot of people at the Cape. There's a lot of people in Houston. Even the other NASA centers like Marshall, I've got a lot of ops people. Some of those are involved now directly in the design, which is good because it's good to have operations people involved with the engineering team from the beginning so that you design it operationally friendly. And so they're not going to be standing around, and of course they got the shuttle to finish up too, but
the actual designing is actually being done by NASA. Is this the first time? I mean, I know that Max Faget and a group designed the Mercury space capsule and all, but is this essentially the first time that NASA has really done the full-on design concept for the spaceflight for spacecraft before they actually hand it off for manufacture?
No, it's really not. In fact, most of Apollo was done that way. All the conceptual design, much of what I call the preliminary design, was done in-house. And with guys like Max and others, he did Mercury and Gemini, but he wasn't the only one. I mean, there were Von Braun and his people down there, and Huntsville did a great job on the Saturn in-house. And the shuttle had quite a lot of in-house concept work done before it was handed over to the contractor. So now, here's what has happened, though. It's been so long since we've had a development program that a lot of the development skills are gone from the agency and gone from the contractors as well. And I know that was worrying Mike Griffin early on, that he essentially had to rebuild a lot of the what I'd call spacecraft development people. He had plenty of ops people. He had program management people. He had facilities and things like that. But some of those skills in the design, and I'm talking about getting out of the drawing board and really designing, a lot of those skills had gone because it had been so long since we've developed any human spaceflight spacecraft.
Do you think that may partially explain why that command module looks awfully familiar?
Yeah. And, well, you know, I think in a way one thing that's happened, and I think this is good, they say if it works, why not, let's just...
If it works, it works.
You know, let's use what we can. There's no sense in reinventing the wheel. Might be able to do something a lot better, but it at probably a premium cost and a lot of time. And if we know that the capsule concept is robust structurally, it's not tender like the shuttle is a tender vehicle. It's kind of on the edge, and we knew that going in.
But here's the question, being that you're a veteran of the Apollo 12 lightning strike, being that this one's by and large going to be a glass cockpit.
Yeah.
Let's say we have an Apollo like 12 lightning strike on the Orion.
Well, you know,
does it go?
The big difference is we learned that we learned in Apollo 12 was that don't launch in those kind of conditions. We actually, you know, you probably know this, but we think we actually generated our own lightning strike.
Yeah.
And so that's why they have all of the lightning detectors now and the potential measure. Yeah, they can actually measure the potential differences. And if they know if they're in a lightning-rich environment, they don't launch, which is good. And I don't think, you know, this thing, I don't worry about that as much now. I think we know so much more about it. We didn't have any measurements like that in Apollo 12. In fact, 12 kind of drove that technology to what could you do to detect the right kind of environment for lightning. And so we've learned a lot more about it. We just simply won't launch anymore when that kind of stuff is around. We're not going to, and we won't have to land in it anyway either, because you can time the entry to put it down where you have to and find the right kind of weather. You know, the shuttle has done that extremely well, I think, between California and New Mexico and the Cape. They can get the thing down on the ground in good weather conditions.
Yeah, and the fact that they have a good half dozen alternate landing sites that they could act, even going into Spain, that they can set her down if they need to.
Right, right. So I think, this thing is like each program is standing on the shoulders of the last one, and you kind of just keep getting higher and higher, but you still got to remember it. It's not easy. I think it was Tiberius who was the old Roman emperor I think he was Roman emperor. He said something supposedly that I've always subscribed to, and that is that it's indeed difficult to fly without feathers. Indeed it is. That's why you have to be damn careful at it.
So let's, I have two more questions for you. The first one is, NASA gives you a call and wants you to come down and talk to the new young Turks who are the flight directors for the return to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Or 15, 20 years from now, some young flight director who's going to do his first mission comes across this broadcast. What do you tell him? What do you say to him?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask that question because we almost had something like that, close to that, just happen. Not too long ago, we had a meeting of all the old flight directors that we could find and a meeting of all the current flight directors. And it was really interesting. It was a very, we did it in Houston. We were in a very relaxed setting. And, of course, we know all of us older guys know each other well, and we know a few of the younger people, but not a lot of them. And there's a number of flight directors now because all the missions are flying with the space station being a constant battle and the shuttle throwing its 2 cents in every once in a while. So there's a lot of flight directors. And it's funny. There is not enough difference. I was looking into the face of these people. There's not enough difference in them and us 35 years ago to put in your hat. I mean, it's just, they're almost exactly the same cut of people. And, you know, if you tried to think of something to tell them, I think I would tell them mainly they've been chosen because they've shown a skill and an ability to lead an effort like this, very complex technically, complex management-wise and so forth. And so trust your judgment. Call it like you see it and don't look back. You know, there's a certain look that these folks have that, and I guess we had it too, and it is an air of confidence. I don't think you could tell them a whole lot. I think they already know what they've got to do. And I really think that the country, it's a little bit like looking in the eyes of, I see these young men and women in Iraq, and the look they have in their eye, and the way, the discipline, and the yes-ers and the no-sers, I see some of that same makeup. I think our young people are, in this country, are damn good. And they will make it happen. I think they're going to make it happen, and they'll do well. And I would just tell them to enjoy it. One thing you got to remember, a flight director, I've always said, is something like an orchestra leader or a symphony conductor. You're not playing the instruments anymore. You got to sit the horn down, and you got to pick up the baton. So the people are going to look to you for leadership and decisions, and it's a different skill, and once you cross over into that, you've got to think leader. You got to think decisive. You got to think, don't make a mistake, and or if you do, learn from it, but don't look back. Heck, they're too hard. There's too many decisions to make. You're gonna screw up some.
And, so it's essentially the same exhortation that Chris Kraft gave you.
Yes, absolutely.
Now my last question is, do you ever get tired of talking about it?
No, I don't. And particularly, let me say, particularly when I'm talking with someone who I can tell has a basic knowledge well, more than basic in your case, but you have enough, you are knowledgeable enough about this that you know what question to ask and what kind of gets the point across that you're trying to make sure that people understand. No, it never gets old. I would be willing to talk about the space business with anybody, anytime I can. It was a big part of my life. It still is. And, I enjoy the heck out of it. I just hope we can keep it going, and I think our people will. I think the country's on the right track, and it's just difficult. We're in that part of NASA's budget is in that discretionary piece. It's not an entitlement program, so you just have to keep fighting for every dollar they need and hope they can get enough to keep going.
I think that about sums it up. My guest has been Jerry Griffin, the flight director for Apollo 12 and just about every moon mission after that. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Conversations with Apollo, a weekly podcast for space history fans everywhere. For more information, visit our MySpace page at www.myspace.com/conversationswithapollo. Or you can leave us feedback on our iTunes website. And if you know anyone who worked on the Apollo program who has a story to tell, we want to hear it. Just have them drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com. Theme music is from Gemini 5, courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network. The song is Babylon Rockets. Visit them on the web at www.gemini5.com. Conversations with Apollo is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quindar Entertainment. Copyright 2007.
Thank you.